So let me introduce Rebecca to you all. Most of you will have seen the emails I've been sending out about it. Rebecca has a doctorate. She's an author, teacher of paganism, witchcraft, and druidry. And her books include The Wheel of the Year, Planetary Magic, and Nature Mystics, a literary guide to modern paganism. Now, if you read any of my e-letters, then you'll know that I really liked this. Those of you who know my background will know that my original trainings were in the Western mystery tradition, magic, and I'm kind of steeped in the literature of my generation and earlier, and I'm waiting to see if anything new arises that we can recommend. And finally, you know, I was saying to Rebecca earlier, I read this quite suspiciously because, you know, I had to for this conversation. And it's not only really good, I'm actually putting my ass on the line a bit here and saying it's the best introduction for intelligent newbies to the subject. Really, really recommend it. And in reading it at another level, my heart just went, ah, yay, a sister, a colleague. So, Rebecca, thank you so much for agreeing to come into this conversation. So let's start off with, I know that you were born on Dartmoor, is that right?
I was born originally. My mum was from Devon, so Devon roots, but she was in Buckinghamshire when I was born. So I was two when I came here. And it's the only home I really remember. It's the one place, Dartmoor is the one place that, I spent 30 years living in London thinking that that's where life was. And, you know, I started out my adult life as an actor. I was convinced that's what I had to be. It was my purpose. How wrong I was. And then, spent 30 years in London and then finally escaped 3 years ago and came home. And it was very much a homecoming, very much.
So let's go back to your childhood.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming that your early years relationship with nature,
mm-hmm.
and possibly invisible beings, subtle beings, was kind of imprinted on you as a little creature?
Yeah.
Is that absolutely right?
I think so, yeah. It's I had my parents living in two different places. So I had my dad living in London. So I spent quite a lot of time in, you know, visiting him from time to time. But for me, it was a very solitary childhood because I was the youngest of three and there was quite an age gap. So my older sister and my older brother weren't really that fussed about playing with me because I was, you know, 6 years and 4 years younger. So really spent my time wandering on Dartmoor with my dog. That was what I did as a child.
What breed was your dog? What was it?
Spaniel. Same as now. I've kind of done full circle. So I'm now 50 and I'm back wandering across Dartmoor with my dog, who's also a spaniel. So it's funny, isn't it, how we kind of you go seeking something and then find it back where you started often. That's one of the ironies, isn't it, of life.
So how old were you at your youngest when you were tootling around Dartmoor with your dog? Did that start?
I was about seven. You know, if you think about when we get when our memories start to develop, I have fleeting memories of being on Dartmoor, you know, as younger than seven. But our conscious minds are said to develop at about the age of seven, aren't they? So I can definitely remember at that point roaming fairly free because it was the 70s and parenting was very different than it is now. And so, yeah, if I was not at school, then I would be out in the fields and the woods and on the moors and, really kind of steeped in it. It's really
when you say steeped in it, what do you mean? And what was going on in your
in my head? I think I was very melancholic. I was a very melancholic child. Spent a lot of the time angsting a lot. It's one of those things. As I've got older, I've got happier in every decade. I sort of angst less than I used to. But I can remember being very imaginative. I was very much interested in fiction and the world of imagination and sort of really, it was the magical universe that I was kind of drawn to. I loved stories that involved magic and nature and, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia and all of those kind of things. So I can remember being on the moor and being out in nature with a head half in fiction, half in a fictional universe, because it seemed a nicer place to be, but the other half definitely on the moor. And my mum was a working mum, so she was off being a social worker at that point. So it was really me and the dog were, you know, bonded quite well, really.
So listen, I realise I'm kind of projecting onto you something that experiences I want you to have had when you were a child, but you may not have actually had them.
Magical experiences.
Were you having them as a child?
I always have this slightly different approach to magic than a lot of people do, because I feel that the magical universe is something that's there, but it's kind of trained out of us, isn't it? We're trained to, oh, you can't believe in magic, that's silly, that's what crazy people do, or that's what, you know, it's not real. And one of the criticisms I had when I started teaching witchcraft, and I was teaching my witchlets planetary magic, and they used to come into the class and say things like, but the universe doesn't look like this, the moon isn't a planet, what are you talking about? And so I feel that we have to give ourselves permission to believe in magic, that it's there, it's all around us, but it's not necessarily, it's our expectations of what it should look like are not always accurate. So we think I should be having visions of the goddess in the middle of Dartmoor, or you know, whatever it is, I should be seeing blinding lights. And for some people that might work, but for me, it's very much, I'm in a very kinesthetic space with the world. So my leading sensory system is how I feel rather than what I see or hear or.
Let me probe in, because you and I, we're actually on the same page.
Yeah.
And when I teach psychic metaphysical stuff, one of the things I'm continually reassuring people about and stressing is that 95, maybe 98% of people have their experiences as subtle sensations, as kinesthetic sensations. There's a very small percentage that's clairvoyantly psychic. And those folk need to unpack the vision to see whether what they're getting is real or not anyway.
Absolutely.
So, and I think most of the people listening to us will understand that very well, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm coming back. I'm like one of your dogs. I'm sniffing.
Yeah, dog with a bone.
So coming back to your childhood.
Yeah.
Knowing that we speak a similar language.
Yeah, absolutely.
Out on the moors, in your kind of Lorna Doone melancholic state, with your spaniel, were you also having a kind of, okay, this feels different in a way that I like?
Yes, and it wasn't really until I left that I understood that. It was one of those, maybe it's because I took for granted that that's how the world feels. And it was only really when I left Dartmoor and sort of set off on this quest to find myself that I really understood how different the world feels when you're in your element and you're surrounded by nature and really connected. Because I think when I first left Dartmoor, I became disconnected from all of that, and I was living in the scientific kind of logical world and really struggling, really, really struggling to find my feet, because it wasn't a world I recognized. It, you know, I felt completely alien, and there wasn't a single day in the 30 years that I was living in London, there wasn't a single day that I wasn't homesick. You know, I was always had this kind of yearning to get back to nature. To the extent that I think in my last 10 or 15 years in London, I've really made efforts to go and find that connection in the city. And I'd go wandering out into all sorts of places looking for woodland and looking for nature, and then finally grasp that unless I had that connection to nature, I was just not going to feel happy in the world at all.
Where did you live in London?
I lived all over. I started in southwest London in Fulham, spent 10 years in Finsbury Park, which was really urban, really, really
That's
like
rough.
graffiti, rough urban. And obviously the day job I was doing meant that, because I've been working in drug and alcohol treatment for 23 years, this is my 24th year starting in January. And so I was used to being in those urban environments and having to interact in a with the underbelly of what was going on in the world, and knew that I needed to, what was missing was nature. That was the thing that was missing that made me make sense to myself.
So what we've got here is we've got quite a polarity
Very much so.
between Lorna Doone girl out on the
Yeah.
moors, and now we're in London, rehab, druggies, Finsbury.
Yeah.
You said earlier when we were chatting that your parents had been frontline workers in that
Yeah,
field.
my mum was a frontline worker, so this is where we get slightly weird in my childhood. I spent part of my childhood growing up in a flat above a hostel for prisoners' families. So on Dartmoor, obviously we've got Dartmoor Prison right up on the High Moor, and my mum ran the hostel that prisoners' families would come and stay in.
Oh, that's pretty
Pretty weird.
cold. Those cold face. Because I mean,
Pretty cold face, yeah.
all right. So listen, look, as you've named that,
Yeah.
let me go to something about Dartmoor, which
Yeah.
before we go back into your biography, right? For me, Dartmoor, of all the places in the UK, has a really weird resonance.
Yeah,
Coming from deep in the land,
definitely, definitely.
and it's people create different stories and myths about what it is that's living under there.
Yeah.
But it's so there you are, and people, if you haven't visited Dartmoor,
Come and visit, it's lovely,
it's lovely.
honestly.
It's lovely, and it has an extraordinary vibe,
It does.
absolutely extraordinary, which you need to, in my opinion. My experience is you have to go, hello, I surrender. Hello, I surrender. I'm friendly.
Absolutely. And I think it's that maybe that it was that surrender that happened fairly early for me. It was an unconscious surrender that must have happened before I was even consciously aware of any of the magical universe or what was going on. It was just that was the one place that I went out to express myself.
Yeah,
So if I
except
was,
you're in this building on top of Con's families, with that vibe
with that vibe going on as
coming
well.
through to you. This is gothic, isn't it?
Very gothic, very gothic. And maybe that's why the literature made such sense to me. You know, that I was reading ghost stories and reading Conan Doyle and, you know, all of those myths and legends, and scaring myself silly probably because I was out, you know. But the one thing I would say is that I feel safer in the middle of Dartmoor where there's nobody around than I ever do in a city. You know, I'm comfortable in both. I can walk quite happily through Finsbury Park on a Saturday night and not worry about it. But I also have this deep-seated need to be in places where there are no other people, that I can just, you know, me and the land.
All right, but listen, but we're moving now on a story that goes Dartmoor, London, urban environment.
There are a few other places in between. But
let me finish, and then we'll come back to your biography. I'm just trying to put the jigsaw together, because in the middle of pagan magical teaching is not simply that, oh, isn't nature lovely, right?
No.
It's also, ooh, we have a relationship with it in such a way that if we cooperate with it in certain ways, we can actually change the atmosphere and the vibration of places, things, events.
Mm.
I mean, that's for me magic. I can actually come into relationship with a different type of vibe and channel it, shift it, move it, create it. So when, Rebecca, in your story of becoming an actor or thespian in London, right?
Absolutely.
And then going back office for drug and rehab.
Yeah.
When along that path did you suddenly get, hello?
Magic.
I can shift the atmosphere if I want to, if I play these strategies.
I'm ashamed to say I did my first spell age 13.
Yeah.
Purely accidentally. Because there was a boy that I liked who didn't like me. And we have these, you know, we have all these rules in Wicca about thou shalt not do love spells. And it was a completely unconscious, unintentional. It was just a imprinting of my will on a situation that wasn't going the way I wanted it to go. And it terrified me because, the thought that you have the power to change things and the knowledge that you can, I think, is more frightening than living in a world where you can't change things, because the it implies that you have then a responsibility, and you've got the responsibility to create your life in the way that you want to, but also have massive resonant effects on other people.
Okay. One. Everybody wants to know this. Did you get to pull him?
I did. And then I didn't know what to do, so I ran away. I was only 13.
I know, but you could have had a kiss. Did you get a kiss?
No, I didn't even do that because I was too terrified even to do that.
Okay. And the second question that people want to know is, what was the spell?
It was purely a moment of anger. I have to say, it was me sitting on a rock on Dartmoor. There were no spell ingredients. There were no conscious discussions about what I was or wasn't doing. It was just an absolute imprint of my will saying, this is what I want to happen, and it's going to happen, and so there. And it, you know, it was a very petulant thing. It wasn't really a... Yeah, it wasn't a conscious, right, I'm going to do a spell now. It was an absolute moment of anger, because I was quite a fiery wee lass, as well as being quite melancholic. I was quite fiery, and it was just, right, this is it. So there.
So when did you then have your reflective moment of going, oh, whoops?
Not until much, much later. So it was only, so often I think when we experience the mystical, certainly age 13, I wasn't equipped to understand what was going on. So it was much, much later when I started to explore modern paganism and reflected back and thought, oh my gosh, that's what I just did when, you know, so it was probably in my 20s when I started to explore paganism as a path, actually my late 20s, wasn't even my early 20s. So it was much, much later. And learning what magic is and how to do it and how, you know, what makes magic work enabled me to think, oh, okay, so these were the ingredients. I had, you know, a need that I felt at the time, plus an emotional resonance that was behind it, and that connection to the universe, because I was out sitting on a rock, as I usually did at that age, kind of howling to the universe, really. You know, it was something I did often, was to go out into nature and be, it was Dartmoor's one of those places you can literally sit on a rock and howl and nobody will hear you for miles, or I thought nobody would. So that's, yeah, it's a much later imprinting of a conscious thought about what was going on.
Right. Let me just tell everybody who's listening that before we started this conversation, Rebecca warned me that she had a dog lying on the floor. And she'd hidden its favourite squeaky toy, because if he played with the squeaky toy, he could end up howling.
Howling to the moon, just like his
own. Yes. which I thought might actually be an appropriate soundtrack for the conversation. But listen, so you're talking now about two things.
Yeah.
When you were 13, you unconsciously did some magic.
Yeah.
And at one level, every single person on this planet is unconsciously putting out a vibe that affects other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people stop doing that either because they become nicer.
Yeah.
Or because they develop a conscience.
Yeah.
Then there's this other track, which in this context is a pagan approach. A pagan magical approach, where we go, okay, everybody is always putting out a vibe. Mm. They can amplify it. They can actually use it to influence people, and certainly change the atmosphere in a room or how someone feels. And in paganism and magic, it's refined to a point where the practitioner consciously knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
With some ethic.
Mm-hmm.
So before we go into the practice, what's your take on the ethics?
For me, the ethics probably is born out of my day job and born out of my upbringing. As a child, as I said, I was quite a temporary, fiery, melancholic child, but I did learn very quickly, hanging around people that were frontline workers, that we have a responsibility. We've all got a responsibility in this life to either live a life where you're focused on your own pleasures and your own, you know, your own existence, or you can use those energies for good as well. So for me, there's this element of, I've always said, I don't think I could work in private business in a setting where there's no social conscience attached to the work at all. And I curse that sometimes, because I'd love to be able to go off and just please myself and not have that feeling of responsibility. But my mum's working world, which I lived in literally, was one where you were kind of concerned about what other people were experiencing. So, yeah, gosh, we're going deep, aren't we, into my kind of inner workings. But it's
important that people, I think, if we're going to talk about pagan magic, I think it's really important that people understand the depth of awareness and conscience. Because I would add to what you're saying, possibly, Sissy, if you agree, a sense that nature, and by nature I'm now meaning the whole flow of the universe, does have a benevolence rolling through it.
Yeah.
And we need to be in tune with that.
And protective of it as well. Because I think, you know, I think there's an element, particularly, you know, not to get too political, but our structures of our society are very much attuned these days to not connecting to that and not thinking about the people that are suffering or that are, you know, in circumstances that are more challenging than the ones we have. Everybody's bringing their own trauma to the table, aren't they? They're all bringing their own experiences of life. And I think as I've learned more about witchcraft and magic and paganism and that power, I've done magic less and less. It's sometimes I have to remind myself, you know, you can do magic, you are allowed. And, you know, I'm getting a lot freer these days at doing spells more often than I have done at certain times.
All right, so let's go back to your 20s then, because we're now going, let's go on a spell thread.
Yeah, spell thread.
Late 20s.
Yeah.
What's your best spell?
So in my late 20s, it was I had the spiritual awakening. I had the Saturn returns experience of waking up and thinking, hang on a minute, I'm a professional actor. I'm doing the thing that I have wanted to do from the age of 6 or 7, or, you know, from childhood. And it's not bringing me fulfillment. It's not making me happy. It's actually making me really unhappy. And there has to be more to life than this, surely. Surely we're not put on this earth to be miserable. So I, at that point, actually took a step back from acting, said, I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to go and discover myself and find my spiritual path, and only go back to acting when I feel I'm not embittered anymore. So it was, you know, I was aware I was getting jaded and really not liking that approach to life at all. The spells actually came much later, I think, that for me, the spiritual path came first. The spells were really, you know, in my early practice, were not very effective. I didn't really know what I was doing. I would do spells for things that didn't come through, that didn't work, and get very frustrated.
Give us an example so people know what you're talking about.
The acting career was one that I, you know, really wanted my acting career to take off and to start being able to earn my living doing it rather than doing the day job in the drug service that was paying the rent and all of the rest of it. So for me, the spells saying I want to be creative. This is the life I want to live is one of being creative. And I want to be able to earn my living doing that. And somehow along the way, this is the irony of life. I am doing the creative stuff and I am being paid for doing some of the creative stuff. But for me today, I still have a need to hold on to the day job because it's that rooted compassion that really grounds me as a person. And the best spells I've done have actually been as I've got older and I'm less concerned with the outcome. I'm not fixed on what I want. What I'm saying differently to the universe is, I'd like you to help me in this area. I've got a blockage here. Can we look at that?
All right. So let's unpack this a little bit for everybody. Going back to your late 20s, there you are, the melancholic,
still melancholic
creature, yeah. has become slightly embittered.
Yeah.
So the hints you've given us thus far on what the spell looked like was basically a repetitive affirmation.
Somehow, but they were also, so I was reading books of magic that were telling me, in order to do this spell, you need 6 candles of this colour and 3 metres of red ribbon. And they weren't really explaining what the purpose of those items was. So I'd be doing things by rote from books and not really understanding the symbolism. Because they don't, you know, often spell books don't teach you the symbolism behind it. They don't teach you the inner structure of what you're doing and what you're about.
We'll come to that in a minute. But just for the moment, because there may be a lot of people who've never heard or read the structure of a spell.
Mm.
One of those spells you did in your late 20s that didn't work, that involved all the paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Could you spell out for folk what one of those actually looked like?
If I can remember rightly, a lot of the books of magic would talk about, say, if we, you know, go back to that theme of a love spell, because that's the one that often people come asking for, isn't it? They would tell you, you know, bring 6 red roses and 4 meters of green ribbon and 5 meters of red ribbon, and bind, you know, write the name of the person, shock horror, because we don't do that. Write the name or the initials of the person on a piece of paper and bind it with your name and initials on another piece of paper, bind them up with ribbon, and then light your candles and sprinkle your red rose petals. And so there are a lot of very complicated actions they expect you to do. And if you don't really get the deep structure of what's happening, A, you feel really silly because it's kind of like, really? You know, do I really have to do this? I spent a fortune on ingredients for things that probably didn't really do any good because I didn't understand the correspondences behind them. I didn't really know why I needed pure rose essential oil or, you know, whatever at £50 a bottle, or, you know, all of these things that the books will tell you. To get a new job, then you need to have a yellow candle or a, you know, so that there's a lot of quite complicated instructions they give you. And the traditional charms and spells from history are very similar, that they give these very complex instructions for things to do. Some of which are, you know, really laughable when you read them, because it's kind of like, okay, and not very nice. So it would say things like, bury a frog in a box underground and go back to it when it's dried powder and use that as an ingredient. So there were, you know, books of magic that are old books of magic that have similarly strange instructions that don't really mean anything. So people have these experiences where they're trying to interact with magic and thinking that they need all these complicated instructions and bits of paper and ribbons and, you know, all the rest of it. When in actual fact, I think all you needed to do is sometimes sit on a rock and have a chat with the universe and say, you know, I'm getting a bit stuck on this. What can we do with that? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. As a practitioner, there's a conversation here also that I would like us to make explicit.
Yeah.
Which is, in the world of anthropology, what we're talking about here is called sympathetic.
Yeah, sympathetic magic. Yeah.
And what's happening is one works with objects and things and tones and colors and sniffs aromas and stuff that have a resonance,
yeah,
vibration that attracts or is in resonance with something similar that will help you
on the spiritual
achieve what, yeah, you want to achieve.
Absolutely.
Now, here's my very practical question. I'm really curious, right? This, you can see here, you'll see here why I've got a PhD as well as you, right?
Yeah.
I'm,
yeah,
really curious. That frog that's dried, wait, let me finish the question. That frog that's dried and turned to powder and buried and then brought up again, right? Was that frog powder got a resonance with?
I guess if you get really into, ironically, the answer is probably in planetary magic. If we think about where frogs sit in, you know, I'm trying to think desperately now what the planetary correspondence is for a frog.
This is great. Come on.
But it's, I don't know if it's that kind of turning a toad into a prince kind of thing, because the instructions for that particular frog spell then tell you to feed it to your intended beloved without them knowing, and it will turn their...
All right. I
never did it.
No, but I hope everybody who's watching and listening will be entertained by the studious look on your face as the doctoral, postdoctoral student tries to work out what is the resonance of powdered frog.
Yeah, thankfully I don't use animal parts in my spellcrafting these days.
If anybody listening knows what the resonance of powdered frog is,
send me an email.
So moving on.
Yeah.
When did you start to feel that the magic you were doing was both ethical, in harmonic flow with benevolent things in the universe, and actually working in a way that was creative.
Yeah, I think that came gradually over time. I started with started reading books on paganism and witchcraft and realizing, okay, this, if I was going to affix a label to myself, then this fits. This feels like home. It feels like an area that I want to learn about, and decided to step back from the acting career and take a year off and explore that for myself a bit further. And I signed up for classes on witchcraft and ended up in some really odd places in London with some really odd people. But then also found some really good people, and always swore blind I wasn't going to join a coven. I wasn't interested in working in a group. I was just going to be a solitary practitioner on my own. But did inevitably find a group and joined a group and went through the process of coven training, which is quite a long, you know, in my tradition, it was a very long training. It was a lot of study. And I started in my late 20s not being very academic. I wasn't really interested in, you know, I would have loved to have gone back to university, but didn't think I was very academic. So was really focused on learning everything I could about paganism and witchcraft.
So what was the tradition that you found?
Gardnerian Wicca. So
say it again.
Gardnerian Wicca. So it's
spell
it out. Gardnerian. So it's Gardnerian. So it's okay. Wicca as in Wicca. People will have encountered the idea of Wicca. If, like me, they're TV and film watchers, they will have seen, you know, things like Charmed and all of that, you know, all of those TV series where they all battle demons. And thankfully, we don't do any of that. It's only inner demons we battle. But it's a path which basically draws us into learning more about yourself, because if you learn more about yourself, then the world starts to make more sense, ironically, but they don't necessarily tell us that at the time. You know, it's something where we are quite studious Wiccans. We do, you know, in certainly in my line, my high priestess was an academic.
Do you need to switch something off?
I've just done it. That's my partner ringing to say, how's your day been? Even though I said to him, I'm doing a thing tonight. But yeah, so it's a path where we study a lot. I was taught to go and read the books of magic, the grimoires, and hence the interest in planetary magic, because that all comes out of those supposedly ancient books of magic, which are kind of really pre-modern in date, not sort of really ancient. But they taught me to understand the underlying structures a bit more. And then I went and studied at the College of Psychic Studies and learnt about psychic development and mediumship and how you can tell the difference between empathy, your own sense of what's going on for other people, and external information that's coming in, if that makes sense. So I was, you know, I'd knew that I couldn't do frontline compassionate work like my mum did, because I couldn't switch off that sort of sponge-like capacity. But learning about psychic development, I learned how to manage that sort of process. And then I studied NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. So I started to understand the unconscious and really get to grips with how the scientific view of magic works as well. So there's, you know, the kind of more psychological based theories about how we interact with the universe and what that means and how you can connect to things and affect things, whilst also working all that time in a compassionate environment.
So how long were you in the Gardnerian training?
I consider myself still in that training. I went in about 2003, was when I started, so it's about 20 years ago. And the approach to life in that path is very much that we, in this world, we die beginners. That's the line I was taught by my teacher, was in this life, you know, in this life, we all die beginners. Your studying never ends. So I've kind of gone through the degree, because it works on an initiatory system. So you are initiated into the coven at first degree. It's a bit like masonry, that it has 3 degrees of initiation that go through the training. So I've gone through all three in about 20 years, and consider myself still learning, really.
Sure. I know a bit about the Gardnerian tradition.
Sorry, I've just seen in the chat, somebody's looked up. Frogs are ruled by the moon.
Don't read the chat.
That caught my attention.
Okay. Frogs are ruled by the moon. Why around Wicca, witchcraft, the Gardnerian tradition in particular, is there a kind of an aura or a perception that it's got something a little bit not nice about it?
You know, witchcraft generally, or just Wicca?
Well, it used to be 30, 40 years ago, it was all witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, television programs have changed all that. But in the world of people who are on the spiritual path, there's a kind of looking at spell working and Wicca and Gardnerian magic, right? As if it were somewhere in which Aleister Crowley and that particular crew had passed the baton.
Which they did, really, didn't they? I mean, it's
But that baton is pretty seedy.
Yes, yeah, it is.
So is it being cleaned up now?
I think it's going through a continual cleanup process. I think the line of, if we take a line of sort of, you know, of where it developed from, we had Freemasonry in the Victorian period. We have this big resurgence of people that are fascinated by folklore. You know, you've got the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, of whom Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is one, who, you know, writes obviously The Hound of the Baskervilles and all the books about Sherlock Holmes. And they're all part of those kind of ceremonial magical traditions that Aleister Crowley was also part of. But he tended to get kicked out of most of the things that he joined. So the Golden Dawn was a group that met in London and was based on male and female practitioners being equal. And it had, you know, William Butler Yeats was involved, and Bram Stoker, and lots of different kind of literary and artistic.
Let me pause you there, because this is the bit I want to get at. You mentioned Bram Stoker.
Yeah.
Let's go to Crowley in a moment. Bram Stoker. We're talking about a kind of a vampiric Dracula type vibe, resonance.
Yeah.
So that Sweetie Pie Christians and Sweetie Pie Sufis and even Sweetie Pie magic makers go, look at...
Don't join those people.
The tradition you're associated with.
Yeah.
And they go, sex magic. What's all that about? And has it changed?
I think in some ways we have a very different approach to life in terms of, so if you take the Christian approach as being one way that you can approach life, that, you know, there's this idea that you're looking for redemption in the afterlife, aren't you? You're hoping that your deeds on this earth will hold you in good stead. With Wicca, what we're doing is we're living an embodied religion. So it's through physical experiences that we reach those mystical experiences. So it might be through dance, or through, you know, drumming, or trance work, or just through Spending time in nature, for me, it's just go out and walk until you find your rhythm with the world, and then that's the connection point. I don't know if, I guess, you know, there is something, isn't there? Because there's the thing about practicing skyclad to start with, that we're initiatory, so there's secretive things going on behind closed doors. And people always want to know if something's a secret, there must be something unpleasant going on there. Most of the witches' circles I've been in have been quite tame in terms of, you know, no orgies, no running about into the woods with, you know, partner swapping and all of that kind of thing. I encountered more of that growing up on Dartmoor in certain communities where that was the, you know, that was how people found their entertainment on Dartmoor, was to undertake activities.
Let me try a thought on you. I'm thinking that one of the elements of paganism that's really good is that it celebrates spirit in flesh. And there are other traditions around the world that do tantra, but in a completely different style. And I'm wondering whether paganism or that form of Western European indigenous spirituality celebrates spirit in flesh through indigenous Western European, British, Celtic dance and maypoles and magic mushroom rings and all that kind of stuff.
It's
And I
the kind of Mists of Avalon feel, isn't it? The,
yeah.
you know, the sense that the landscape around us is magical, and you just have to find a way of tapping into that.
Yeah, but it's got a there's a vibe to it, and I'm exploring this as a beginner, that's kind of juicy, and prepared to take some risks with the juiciness, and
We put
that's.
ourselves on the line every time we go into a circle. So for me, you know, I talk about going into a circle. Basically, that's the witch's sacred space that we create in, you know, whenever we gather as a group. And there's, you know, we do practice skyclad, we practice naked, and that's something that most people are kind of like, well, there's got to be number one problem there. If you're getting naked with other people, what's going on? You know, there must be some sexual element to it, but it isn't. It's a very, the putting yourself in a position of vulnerability, both in front of the other people in your group and your gods, you know, in front of the universe. We're kind of presenting ourselves as we are born, you know, and taking away the safety nets that exist in life, you know, that society's created for us. Those little points of control that make us feel safe, which in my 20s I was desperately holding on to. But I think possibly as I've got older, I've got less controlling of my life and how I exist in the world and how I'm presented. And that enables me to take those risks more.
Yeah, I suppose standing naked with your
Or
peers
by candlelight.
or by candlelight with spirit is a way of deconstructing and melting a lot of the status armor, a lot of the trauma armor.
Absolutely.
It's daring. It's daring, and it's actually the way you're talking about it is the very opposite of something that's lascivious and corrupt. It's actually.
It's there's a purity to it. I feel there's a purity to it in the sense of you have to face all your stuff, all your baggage. If you're going to do that, you know, I can remember before I did it being terrified of the idea of being naked in front of other people, because we all, you know, we're taught, aren't we, in this society that your body should look a certain way and your skin should look a certain way and your hair should be doing something in particular. And it's taking away all of those things that we grip onto, and taking you back down to a level where, in a witch's circle, we begin with, before we do anything in my coven, what we do is start with a self-dedication prayer. So each person goes to the altar and, you know, they've got the candles and the incense, and it's them and their connection to the divine. And it's a retaking of your oath every time we are in that place.
Is there a structure to the dedication prayer?
Everybody writes their own. So it's one of the tasks once you go through initiation is to compose your own self-dedication prayer. And it's I think one of the loveliest things I've ever been asked to do is to express in, you know, it's, and everybody's self-dedication prayer, I could, you know, obviously we're not supposed to share exactly the content and who's there and all the rest of it, but everybody's self-dedication prayer perfectly describes their own relationship with the universe and what they're doing and what they feel their life's purpose is, what they feel they've been put here on the planet to do. So I've got a friend who's a doctor who talks about, you know, my hands to heal. And, you know, I know other people who are full-time mums who are here to really pour all their energy into their family, and that's expressed through their prayer. And other people kind of go for the classical, you know, they're brought in by the sort of love of the classical paganism and what that might have looked like. So their prayers are more classical in feel, more poetic. So it's a task I often set students if we're in a certain setting that where you can be vulnerable. I often say to them, think about what you would be telling the universe if the channels were open and you're in a direct communication with the divine. What is it you want the divine to know? And obviously a big element of that is the divine already knows what you want it to know, because it's both within us as well as outside of us. As above, so below, you know, it's the old sayings are there for a reason, really.
That's very moving. That touches my heart, the way you describe it. And I think it may well be the first time that a lot of people listening have come into resonance with the purity of a naked prayer in a naked circle.
It's absolute surrender, isn't it? It's the you know, one of the hardest lessons I learned probably in my late 30s and 40s was the idea of surrender, of literally giving it all back. Stop trying to control everything and just give it all back to the universe to do it for you. Because there are times when we try and control life and we don't really know the bigger picture. We don't really understand where we sit in relation to everything around us. So there's that point where you might be asking for something magically, and how can you know the impact it's going to have on everybody around you? Whereas if you place it in a position of surrender and say, this is what I think that I'm supposed to be doing, but I'm going to ask you to point me in the direction you want me to go in, that when I took my oath as a first degree witch, It was to live a life as priestess, to have that sense of not necessarily a mission in the world, because that sounds very monotheistic, but that we have a role to play on behalf of the universe, that we're here not only for our own benefit, but for other people as well. And that very much for me resonates in the idea that when you're acting as co-creator rather than I'm in control of everything, you know, it's like makes you know, we're not Bond villains, we're there to kind of facilitate something on behalf of the universe, I think. It's a life of service rather than one of acquisition.
Okay, so listen, we're coming to the end of this conversation, and I want to appreciate you for the vibe and the atmosphere we've gone into in the last 15 minutes. It's very pure, very benevolent, very aligned. It's a blessing for all of us, I'm sure. If you agree with me, can you just wave and if you're out there? That's the vibe, isn't it? Isn't that lovely, considering how we started and got a bit intellectual at one point?
Yeah.
So listen, before we end, how's your melancholia and Lorna Doone syndrome?
It's so much better.
Yeah.
I think we said, didn't we, when we were chatting at the beginning, that there's a line in one of the prayers that says, do it with mirth and reverence. And I have to say, as each decade has found me, I've kind of reached a place of being happier than the decade before. So I'm at 50 now, and I kind of think, well, it can only go upwards, can't it?
So let's say it again. It's mirth.
Mirth and reverence.
Mirth and reverence. Okay. So listen, you've brought a blessing through for all of us. I'm going to spring something on you. Give us a quick blessing to end this. To end this.
Ooh.
Just whatever words. Yeah, whatever words. Give us a blessing. And I'm going to try and take us off spotlight so that we're all together. But we'll hear your voice. And if people go to view and come down to gallery, they'll see everybody.
What a lovely view.
So give us a blessing, Rebecca, and then I'll let everybody wave a gratitude thing to you.
I'm actually going to give you, this is completely against all the rules, but I'm going to share with you my personal self-dedication that I give whenever I'm in a witch's circle. Which is to say, we acknowledge that deity is both male and female and everything in between. So I always start with my blessing, which is Lord of the Veiling Mists and Lady of the Running Pool Waters. I ask that you bless us in this place, all these souls that have come together, and that we approach this space with an open heart and with an eye on the magic in the world that exists for us, if we can only free ourselves of the expectations that we sometimes place upon ourselves. May we cease seeking perfection and embrace our beautiful imperfection and be with you always. So might it be.
Well, people, you can unmute yourself now and we can wave to Rebecca together and say thank you for what
thank you
beautiful
thank you
very much for sharing.
Thank you.